and I expect we'll probably have a few more members of the advisory panel join along the way. But we have pretty good turnout as is. We're also recording today's roundtable for any panel members that were maybe not able to attend today. So I'm Jared Snyder. I'm Deputy Commissioner at DEC, in charge of the climate and energy programs, or climate air pollution and energy programs. And I'm very pleased to sort of kick off today's roundtable discussion. Really want to thank the participants in the roundtable for volunteering their time today to provide us the benefits of their experience, research, and insights they have. I think the timing of this conversation is great. We have a meeting of the full advisory panel on Friday, and you know this conversation will be fresh in our minds as we, you know, sort of move towards finalizing the recommendations of this advisory panel to present to the full Climate Action Council. So I just want to provide a little bit of background. The CLCPA, Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, is really sets the framework for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in New York. And the Transportation Advisory Panel that is sponsoring today's roundtable is responsible for coming up with the recommendations for the transportation sector. How do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector? But at the same time, the CLCPA also emphasizes a number of other goals. And one of those is providing benefits to disadvantaged communities that have been overburdened by pollution sources and may often, you know, bear the brunt of climate change. How do we create a just transition? How do we reduce co-pollutants? You know, make sure that the recommendations that we produce also reduce co-pollutants. And so those are all very important pieces of the work that we're doing. And so today's roundtable is an opportunity to hear from a number of experts and advocates who have experience and expertise in this subject area. You know, we look forward to hearing about research efforts that have explored the contributions of vehicle traffic and other sources to elevated air pollution levels. We also look forward to hearing about what has worked in other jurisdictions, you know, particularly California. We have a few representatives, people with experience in California on today's conversation, and you know, want to understand what's worked in other jurisdictions and maybe what hasn't worked, because we can learn from that as we you know, produce our recommendations. So before we get into that discussion, I just wanted to provide the participants on the panel or on today's roundtable with a little bit of background on the recommendations that we are considering at the moment. There's really two primary pillars of our recommendations. One is, you know, make the vehicles that we get around in cleaner, which, you know, means primarily electrification, but also, you know, potentially fuel cell vehicles for some uses. And, you know, we'd achieve that with regulations that require the manufacturers of cars, trucks, buses to sell an increasing amount of zero emission vehicles, up to 100% of auto sales no later than 2035, and 100% of sales of truck and buses not long thereafter. And this would be based on our authority to adopt the California regulations. Now, we want to be sure that the disadvantaged communities get the benefit of these cleaner vehicles. In most cases, that provides greater public health benefits because, you know, those are the communities that are usually densely populated with a large amount of vehicle traffic, particularly truck traffic with diesel emissions. And so how do we sort of complement that mandate with strategies that get those vehicles, you know, located in these communities where we get, you know, sort of very substantial public health benefits? So the ideas that we're considering include targeting incentives for disadvantaged communities, targeting incentives for clean trucks and buses in disadvantaged communities, and also targeting incentives for low-income consumers to buy electric vehicles and, you know, potentially use electric vehicles as well to make sure that, you know, those communities that have, you know, to some extent been bypassed by the strategies to get electric vehicles on the street so far, make sure that they're able to benefit from that electrification. So that's one primary pillar. The second is programs that you know, enable people to use alternatives to the single occupancy vehicle. And that includes expanded access to public transportation, a variety of smart growth strategies that will reduce sprawl, and, you know, encourage sort of more sustainable development that enable people to take advantage of public transportation services. So those strategies, we believe, will also benefit disadvantaged communities that are often underserved by public transportation services, but recognize that, you know, the devil can be in the details. So, you know, we're really interested in the thoughts of the participants on this roundtable and how to you know, sort of target those strategies to make sure that, you know, we are providing really a suite of social justice benefits in all our communities. We're also considering a recommendation to adopt a clean fuel standard that would both support electrification and also the use of other cleaner fuels in the sort of internal combustion engines, the gas-powered vehicles, diesel-powered vehicles currently on the road. So as we move to electrification as quickly as we can, you know, the possibility of using some cleaner fuels in the sort of gas and diesel-powered vehicles that remain on the road. And other strategies we're considering would support the financing and funding of a number of these strategies. One of those is potential participation in the regional Transportation and Climate Initiative, which is a cap and invest program, and targeting investment of a large portion of the proceeds to support clean technologies in disadvantaged communities. So we look forward to your insights as we move forward with finalizing these recommendations over the next couple of weeks before we present them to the Climate Action Council in May. So hopefully that's good background for this conversation. And let me turn things over to our moderator now. Toby Berkman is a senior associate at the Consensus Building Institute, and he's on the affiliated faculty in the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School. An attorney by training, Toby has been facilitating dialogue and mediating complex public issues for more than a decade. And his work focuses on helping organizations and stakeholders collaborate more effectively and advance equity around difficult public issues, including transportation, climate change, energy, and land use issues that we're you know, considering today. He's recently worked with the Massachusetts State Senate to develop a statewide vision for the future of transportation in Massachusetts, and has also worked with on a number of New York issues with NYSERDA. So, Toby, thank you for bringing your expertise and experience to this conversation, and let me turn it over to you now.
All right. Thanks so much, Jared. That's really great and helpful background and sets the stage nicely. So welcome, everyone, to this roundtable conversation. I'm really, really excited to hear from our panelists. We have five fantastic panelists joining us today from New York, from New Jersey, from out in California, who have lots of fantastic research, knowledge, and experience to share with us. Just to, you know, reiterate what Jared said around the purpose of today's session, right? We're hoping to explore transportation strategies and policies that could and will provide benefits to communities that are often overburdened by air pollution and that may have very limited access to clean transportation alternatives. So just to say, this is an idea exploration exercise, right? This is an opportunity for us to bring in some new voices who have incredible experience in this area to inject some new thinking into the transportation advisory panel to really kind of maybe open our minds a little bit, bring in some new ideas. So I'm going to introduce our panelists in just a minute, but just a few words about how the session is going to run and what you can expect. So in a couple minutes, I'm going to ask an opening question to each panelist that builds off of their experience or some recent research that they've done, give them an opportunity to share a bit about their recent work or experiences. I'm going to ask each panelist to keep their response to this opening question relatively brief, you know, in the 3 to 5 minute range, with just a goal of getting all of their voices in the room at the outset. And then following that, you know, we'll have a number of follow-up questions, maybe directed more generally to the panelists to chime in as they feel appropriate. And we'll have a little more of an informal conversation. At some point, I'm imagining maybe about midway through this session, we're going to open it up to questions from the transportation advisory panel members as well, give you a chance to ask what's on your mind and give our panelists a chance to respond. With that, I'd love to just go ahead and briefly introduce each of our panelists before going ahead and asking them each a question. So I'd love if when I introduce you, if you could just say a quick hello, make sure you turn your camera on if you're able, panelists, so we can see your faces, and just, you know, give you an opportunity to briefly greet the group. So first, I'm going to introduce Jalissa Gilmore. Jalissa is a research analyst at the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance at NYC EJA. Jalissa's work includes research and advocacy to support NYC EJA's different environmental health initiatives to promote equitable, resilient, and healthy communities. Her work primarily focuses on climate change-induced extreme weather, pollution prevention, air quality monitoring, and promoting green infrastructure in environmental justice communities. So hi, Jalissa, you want to just say a brief welcome?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jalissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jalissa. And apologies, I'll get your name right from now on. All right. Ana Isabel Baptista is an assistant professor of professional practice and also serves as the associate director of the Tishman Environment and Design Center at the New School University. Ana's research is focused on advancing environmental justice through collaborative work with communities on a variety of issues, including climate justice, air pollution, and zero waste. She is also a trustee and active member of the New Jersey Environmental Justice Alliance, the Ironbound Community Corp, and Gaia. Ana, please just say a quick welcome.
Hi, everyone. Good to be with you.
Great, Ana. Wonderful to have you. Will Barrett leads the American Lung Association's work on clean air and climate change policy in California, focusing on vehicle emission standards, smart growth, and clean energy and fuels policy. Since joining the American Lung Association team in 2009, Will has represented the ALA before state legislatures and federal, state, and regional and local agencies engaged in clean air and climate policy. In this role, Will also supports the American Lung Association's clean air and climate policy efforts across the country. Will, please say a quick hello.
Hey, everybody. Looking forward to the conversation, and thanks for having us.
Great. Welcome, Will. Martha Dina Arguello is Executive Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility, Los Angeles. For the past 32 years, Martha has served in the nonprofit sector as an advocate, community organizer, and coalition builder. She joined PSRLA in 1998 to launch the environmental health programs and became executive director in November 2007. She is committed to making the credible voice of physicians a powerful instrument for transforming California and our planet into a more peaceful and healthy place. All right, please give a brief greeting, Martha.
Good morning and greetings from Los Angeles to all of you. I'm really happy to be here, and it's good to see some Cali folks on the phone.
All right. Welcome, Martha. And last but certainly not least, Hannah Krieger is Senior Program Manager of Climate Equity at the Green Lining Institute. She works on the development and implementation of policies and programs leading to clean transportation and mobility investments that will benefit low-income communities of color. Hannah serves on a number of advisory committees for cities, agencies, universities, and nonprofits for projects relating to shared mobility, public transit, electric mobility, and autonomous vehicles. Welcome, Hannah.
Hi, everyone. Looking forward to the conversation. Thanks for having us.
So, as you all can see, a really fantastic panel with, I think, great diversity of perspectives, both from here in the Northeast and California, that we're hoping will really benefit the Transportation Advisory Panel and bring some new thinking into the mix. Julissa, I thought I would start off with you. I'll get it right eventually, I promise. So in your role at the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance, you were heavily involved in a recent community air mapping project for environmental justice, or Camp EJ. I'd love it if you could just share a little bit, tell us about some of the key findings and recommendations from that study.
Yeah, thanks. So NEJA's Camp EJ, or Community Air Mapping Project for Environmental Justice, was a grassroots air quality monitoring campaign led by six of our members who are environmental justice community-based organizations in the South Bronx and Brooklyn. And this was really to measure, to map, and understand their exposure to PM2.5 air pollution. And so this initiative, or this project, was really in response to our members' concerns around air quality and health in their communities. And so using AirBeams, which is a low-cost air quality monitor, NEJA worked with our members in their communities to collect and visualize hyper-local air quality data so that we can improve air quality, public health, and then also community development. And some of the goals of this project were really to raise awareness about these disproportionate health impacts in environmental justice communities like asthma, COVID-19, and really better understand what the air quality is like in environmental justice communities. So we really wanted to capture localized emissions in the community and identify potential hotspots that, you know, government monitors weren't necessarily capturing. And so some of the findings were we did find pollution hotspots in these neighborhoods, and a lot of this was because of local facilities and the transportation sector, unsurprisingly. So like in the South Bronx, one of the pollution hotspots was the Hunts Point Food Distribution Center, which there is an estimate of 15,000 traffics daily in that area. And also in the South Bronx, there was a hotspot in what is called the Toxic Triangle, which was the Sheridan Expressway, the Cross Bronx Expressway, and the Bruckner Expressway, all in this one neighborhood. And it was a similar thing also in North Brooklyn. We also found hotspots, which was actually in front of one of our members, their offices. And so that's like right near the Williamsburg Bridge. And also there's an MTA bus depot right there. So a lot of this was really coming from the transportation sector. And then we also found that not only was the transportation sector and facilities, but also that traffic congestion in general in these communities were contributing to poor air quality. So we found that the measurements rose with the morning rush hour traffic, decreased, and then rose again with the nighttime traffic. And then kind of the last finding that's not so transportation related, but obviously has connections, is that really we saw that PM2.5 concentrations fluctuate significantly just from one block to another. And we found that in some cases, some of these air beam measurements were 20 times higher than the state run monitors. But also some of the fixed air beams, just in general, could be three times as higher on the next block. So it's really showing that within these neighborhoods, there's a lot of variability in terms of PM2.5 measurements. And so some of those policy implications are just, obviously, we need targeted interventions for these hotspots that we're finding in environmental justice communities, but also considering that a lot of these sources were from the transportation sector and traffic, we really need to focus on this, which is, you know, the topic of this conversation today. And the third one is really that since we're seeing this hyper-local data is so important to understanding what's happening at the community level, we really need to make sure that we're supporting community-based organizations and local communities and to be able to do more air quality monitoring like this so that we can get better, more targeted recommendations.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Julissa. And for those of you who maybe haven't had a chance to look at the CAMP study, I just highly recommend it. The findings are really amazing, just with the level of granularity that was captured through the citizen monitoring. It's really fantastic and impressive work. So thanks so much for sharing, Julissa. So I'd like to turn now to Ana Isabel Baptista. So Ana, you have also been involved with some recent research, developing community-based participatory research on the impacts of mobile source emissions in Newark. So this is a little bit different from Julissa's research in that this is a modeling effort in Newark. Would love to hear just a bit from you about the research that was conducted and some of the main findings that you think would be most helpful for the TAP to know about.
Sure, yeah. So the study that you're referring to is the Newark emissions study we did in the area in and around the Port of Newark and Elizabeth. And the context for that study is, over a decade of advocacy work around trying to reduce diesel-related emissions from the port sector. In our community, we have a coalition called the Coalition for Healthy Ports, and frankly, being frustrated by the voluntary measures and incentive programs to try to put a dent in the drayage sector. It also frustration with the TCI process. The environmental justice community in New Jersey opposed the TCI for its lack of ambition and lack of targeted emissions reductions in environmental justice communities. So many of the climate mitigation strategies that we're seeing focused on the transportation sector are very carbon centric and very focused on light duty vehicles, the passenger vehicle electrification, and not enough attention is being placed on the diesel sector, which is harming communities now. So there's a very detrimental impact from the co-pollutants in the transportation sector, things like black carbon and diesel and PM. That are health harming. And so this study was sort of undertaken to look at a hotspot, not unlike the South Bronx that Julissa mentioned. The city of Newark is the host to a large amount of regional transportation infrastructure. The seaports, the airport, and major highways all traverse this area. And 40% of Newark households are transit dependent, meaning they have no access to an individual household vehicle. So electrification of vehicles is not going to help Newark in their effort to breathe clean air in their community. So what we did is we partnered with MJ Bradley Associates as a consultant. This report was funded by NRDC, and we did an emissions modeling to really try to get a comprehensive picture of the emissions of both co-pollutants and CO2 from all the various aspects of the transportation sector. This means both marine and ground transportation, area sources, mobile sources, And we looked at PM2.5, black carbon, and NOx as significant co-pollutants that have health-harming impacts, as well as CO2, and evaluated electrification pathways. So we looked at total emissions from these transportation sectors, as well as emissions exposure, which are relative measures of emissions exposure from those sectors. And, you know, what we found in the study, and you all methodologies highlight many of which will not be surprising to those of us who have been working in environmental justice. One, location matters. Location of residential areas in close proximity to transportation infrastructure like rail yards, truck routes, and seaport infrastructure means that those areas are most heavily impacted by emissions exposure. The other thing that we found that was not surprising, but really drives home this point about the focus, is that the emissions of PM2.5, black carbon, and NOx, the highest from non-roadway sources, have the highest air quality impact in the study area, followed by medium and heavy duty vehicles. And these three sources, these non-passenger vehicle sources, far outweigh the emissions from passenger vehicle. It contributed 95% of the emissions in the area. So that, for example, the full amount of PM2.5 in our community is,
We just missed what you said, Fifteen to 20 seconds on with a little bit of a audio issue, so maybe just you can kind of cycle back and please start to interrupt.
These co-pollutants make up 95% of the total emissions exposure in the area that was modeled. That's about over 160 metric tons of PM2.5 from this sector. And of course, some of the recommendations that came out of the report were really the call for a very focused and regulatory approach to mandates that drive down emissions and enforce emissions reductions in this sector, in the diesel sector, to improve health outcomes in EJ communities that are enforceable. We want a dedicated action that will have tangible impacts in EJ communities. So instead of TCI, we are proposing, and we have been in talks with the governor's office and the DEP around adoption of many of the California related rules, like the California Advanced Truck Rule. We're looking at the Omnibus Rule. We're also looking at the Advanced Clean Trucks Rule, and looking at the Advanced Clean Fleets and Drayage Truck Rules, as well as the Zero Emission Zones for ports. And in-use engine standards, in-use diesel engine standards. All of these are regulations that try to really target this sector and drive down co-pollutant emissions in EJ communities, rather than waiting for investments much further down the line. The sort of trickle-down approach to environmental justice, where we get the promise of investments and maybe some marginal emissions reductions later, is just not enough for communities that are choking on diesel now. So we are really looking at much more aggressive mandates that drive these emissions of co-pollutants now. So I can answer questions more about the study later.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Anna. Really clear recommendations and great work with the study. It's also a great resource for those of you who aren't familiar with it. So I'm going to turn now to Will. And Will, I know you were having some connection issues. Are you back with us? I'm hoping.
I am back with you, yes.
Okay, great. All right, glad you sorted that out. So Will, in your role at the American Lung Association, you help educate policymakers about the public health impacts of transportation fuels. So I'd love if you could just share with us what you can about the health implications of some of the research findings that we just heard Jalissa and Anna share about, these elevated levels of PM2.5, of NOx, of black carbon, right? What can you share with us about what that actually means for sort of the lifetime health outcomes of people in those communities?
Sure. Well, thanks again for having us on. The Lung Association really is focused on addressing the transportation sector. We know that transportation pollution is the leading contributor to poor air quality and our climate health crisis. So ultimately, we have to do more. We have to do more rapidly to reduce the impacts of combustion in the transportation sector that's impacting so many lives. We also, as we heard, lower income communities and communities of color often bear a disproportionate burden from poor air pollution due to local sources, these diesel hotspots that were mentioned, things like our ports, rail yards, major highways, and those kind of things, really compound the burdens in communities where there is a real concentration of diesel exhaust and other harmful pollutants. And these ultimately, to your point, these translate into real public health crises. Translate into increased asthma attacks, pediatric asthma attacks, heart attacks and strokes due to particle pollution that can actually get deep into your lungs, bypass the body's defenses, cross over into the bloodstream, and have respiratory, or on top of respiratory impacts, cardiovascular impacts. We also know that there's a wide range of not only impacts in terms of asthma, but developmental harm to lungs, children's lungs as they're developing. When kids are exposed to higher levels of pollution, have these developmental harms that can last a lifetime, unfortunately. So we know that there's a wide range of negative health consequences to elevated air pollution burdens, largely, again, driven by the transportation sector and combustion of fossil fuels. We know also that, unfortunately, transportation pollution, particle pollution in particular, can translate into lung cancer and ultimately premature death. I'm not sure what the numbers are for New York, but currently California's estimate is about 5,000 deaths per year due to particle pollution, about half of those deaths due to the transportation sector contribution to particles. In our annual report, The State of the Air, the American Lung Association in 2020 found the New York City metropolitan area is the 12th most ozone polluted city in the United States that has significant impacts on lung health, again, largely driven by the transportation sector, especially in terms of the medium and heavy duty sector. And we know that has a significant impact. There are 330,000 children in the New York metro area with asthma, about 1.7 million adults with asthma who are just at greater risk because of these air pollution impacts, again, driven by the transportation sector. And again, we know that the harms of transportation pollution are often concentrated in communities that are significantly underrepresented, underinvested, and have for far too long borne the disproportionate burdens of pollution. The Union of Concerned Scientists recently put out a study showing 74% of Black and Latino people in New York State live where particle pollution levels exceed the state averages. So again, higher levels of pollution exposure due to transportation pollution translating into health inequities as well as quality of life impacts, and unfortunately health impacts leading up, including to premature death. So I would say that the suite of policies that were kind of discussed at the outset, the focus on transportation electrification, the focus on alternatives to passenger vehicle dependency, so alternatives like increased walking, biking, transit options, as well as really, again, the focus on regulations is critical. I think looking at development of the clean fuel standard to cut the burdens of or the climate pollution burdens of transportation fuels is critical. I think looking at the low NOx truck standard is critical, the California low NOx truck standard, the California Advanced Clean Truck Standard, as well as the suite of programs that can be put in place to really invest in communities that are most impacted, and making sure that the benefits of these regulations are really targeted in communities where they're needed the most. I'll end by noting, just on the electrification front, that the Lung Association put together a report last year called The Road to Clean Air, and that report basically looked at what would the public health benefits be if we had a widespread transition to zero emission technologies across the light duty, medium, and heavy duty sectors. And what we found was basically that we could look at, for the New York metro area, which was one of the top places in the country that we found that would have significant public health benefits through transportation electrification, we found annual benefits could be $5.2 billion just in the New York metro alone. And that includes, you know, counties in Connecticut, New Jersey that make up the broader region. For in-state benefits, we found $4 billion in annual public health benefits through this transition to zero-emission technologies. And that's, you know, hundreds of lives saved, thousands of asthma attacks avoided, tens of thousands of lost work days avoided, because the air will be that much cleaner as we transition off of combustion onto cleaner zero-emission technologies. So with that, I'll leave it there and look forward to the rest of the conversation. So thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Will. That's super helpful background. So I want to turn now to Martha Arguello. So in addition to your role at PSR LA, or as part of your role at PSR LA, you've been on the California Air Resources Board's Global Warming Environmental Justice Advisory Committee for well over a decade at this point. So you've been involved in a lot of conversations, a lot of advocacy on behalf of the EJ community out there in California. I think, you know, we'd love just to hear from you some broad lessons from your experiences out there. You know, what has California done right to address impacts on disadvantaged communities from transportation pollution? And what has it done wrong, or what has it maybe failed to do enough of?
Okay, well, I'm going to start with, I know, I'm like, what have we done right? Well, you know what, I'm going to start with the one thing that they haven't gotten right. And even though we fought in the negotiations around AB 32 to ensure that the voice of environmental justice communities was at the table and part of setting the table, we just sort of got invited to lunch and didn't get to choose the menu. And not everybody got served some food, is my best analogy. And so what I would say is, my best advice is listen to the environmental justice. I've just heard two presentations from folks who are there, who all would have said almost identical what I would have said, is focus on air pollution. No facility just emits carbon. And so if you are only focused on the carbon part, you're going to miss a lot of potential measures to address community, to address air pollution. And then, at the end of the day, this is about air pollution first, because it's how people experience the localized impacts of climate. And so, you know, again, this obsession with carbon led to a lot of solutions that may not have been the best thought out. And I will also remind folks who don't know that what happened in California, the environmental justice community had some experience with trading programs in the South Coast Air District where I live. And it had not been an effective program, and it had actually helped incentivize the creation of hotspots in localized communities. So understanding the full life cycle of whatever your alternative is, so from the low carbon fuel standard to biofuels, where is it getting produced? What are the localized land use and transportation and justice impacts of the production, as well as the distribution and use? And we just always said, whatever bridge you're building better be really narrow and short. So you don't want to build big infrastructure that you're going to have, that is going to continue the cycle of the benefits and burdens distribution of your policies ends up with most of the burdens being placed on low-income communities, and many of the benefits from the money and the air pollution actually not going to low-income communities. So you don't want that to happen. And how you do that is you listen to the environmental justice community. You set a place at that table where communities can actually be engaged in the co-design and the monitoring of these programs. And, you know, we also did community monitoring, and we found much of the same thing, you know, the variation from block to block. We also had to, you know, walk through communities to verify the pollution sources, because we didn't often have the full information. So what we found in our communities is crisscrossed by freeways, lots of stationary pollution sources that together make up a huge cumulative burden of toxic air contaminants. So the community is now, South LA, where we do a lot of our work, is now a part of one of the fixes that California did to AB 32 to actually address the air pollution issue in California, and that was AB 617, which was not what the community asked for. The community has been asking for direct emissions reductions, right? We want to remind regulatory agencies that they were created to regulate, and they should regulate, not administer programs. And I think that has been sort of a direction that has shifted at our air district, and I think it's problematic for getting us to the reductions that we need. And again, what we found at the local level, you know, oil drilling in people's backyards, dry cleaners, metal manufacturers, metal shredders, auto body shops, plastic pellet production, this whole very toxic life cycle that was happening in those communities. And now through 617, every year, a few more communities are selected for these very targeted air monitoring and air improvement plans. But what it has forced is, you know, what I call the oppression Olympics, is that each community comes and says, no, I'm more polluted. No, I'm more polluted. Let us have these resources. And so that fix, again, because the environmental justice community wasn't listened to and was offered it to us as a solution, which was not the solution to the problem that we had of, we should be targeting, you know, absolutely the transportation sector. And I'll talk less because I think the other speaker actually has worked a lot more on transportation. But I agree. It's trucks, trains, automobiles, rail yards, the ports, buses, public fleets, you know, and again, PM 2.10, 2.5, black carbon. These are the sources we really need to focus on. And then the other thing, you know, what I would say is, whatever you come up with, I'm going to say it again because it bears repeating, listen to the environmental justice community, move away from decide, announce, and defend. And what I would have done that I wish we would have done is actually have a better way of measuring benefits and burdens about the policy solutions that you develop. What we found is a lot of the smart growth and vehicle mile travel reduction strategies, anti-sprawl, because LA's got lots of sprawl, had a lot of unintended consequences, so much so that we actually stopped calling them unintended consequences. So when you've got displacement, gentrification, increasing cost of energy, all falling on low-income communities more than, at some point we had to ask, is this by design? And so we need to start talking about how we're designing the policies at a really fundamental level and getting better about measuring those benefits and burdens and having a principle of first do no harm. Right? So communities that have already been harmed should not bear the brunt of greenhouse gas reduction strategies that are designed for the top of the market, right? If you design for the bottom of the market or the people most impacted, whether that's an electric vehicle program, solar roof programs, right? All of the building electrification programs, we all said you need wraparound services. You can't add upfront costs to low and middle income communities, right? Because in California, we talk about the impacts on low-income communities and ultra-low-income communities, often not understanding that a lot of the climate policies impact directly middle-class people's ability to buy a home, build a home, remodel a home, add an ADU. And so, again, if you center on justice and you center on the most impacted, when they're at the table to co-design the policies, and then not believe your own dogma that cap and trade is the only solution, right, for raising revenues. And I think that's the, you know, I'm going to stop. There's a lot of lessons we learned. But, you know, this dogma that cap and trade is the only solution, or cap and dividend or these others, right, versus really understanding the life cycle of fuels and where we are supporting those and moving those resources, you know, so we can reimagine what clean air might look like and what safe communities could be like if we actually focused on protecting our lungs.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Martha. So last but not least in our lineup of speakers here, we're going to turn to Hannah Krieger. So Hannah, you were involved in the Green Lining Institute's recently released Clean Mobility Equity Playbook. And this playbook evaluated California's investments in mobility equity, and it details a series of best practices to make equity real. in clean mobility programs. So I think I'd love to hear you just share some of the key findings of the playbook with us, and in particular, those you think would be most important, most helpful for New York to consider as this panel thinks about how to address transportation equity.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to share. And I first just want to say how honored I am to speak alongside just so many amazing folks doing incredible work around the country. I completely second all of the points that have been made already. And for those of you who are not familiar, Greenlining is a research and public policy nonprofit. We've been advocating for racial equity and economic justice for about 28 years now. And we're primarily based in California, but we're increasingly kind of proactively sharing our lessons learned with other states and the federal government. And so over the years, our team had been very involved with the development and implementation of California policies and programs that then led to the creation of a wide variety of clean mobility equity pilots and programs that aim to reduce air pollution and emissions in our most impoverished and polluted communities. And as a result, we've seen California's investments in these programs really balloon in a pretty short amount of time. So for example, we have financial incentives for electric vehicle purchases, we have diesel school bus replacements, we have electric vehicle car sharing mobility hubs, and these new community-driven clean mobility pilots. And a selection of these are solely targeted towards low-income folks, EJ communities, people of color, tribal communities, migrant farm workers, and other folks who really need these services most. And I want to be clear, this is not just happening in urban areas. This is also occurring in suburban and rural communities, which is super unique and exciting. And so over the years, we've advocated for these equity programs to more intentionally center equity in a really comprehensive and intersectional way. Because it's our belief that clean mobility programs shouldn't just fight climate change and clean the air. They should also be improving mobility, reduce traffic dependency on cars, and importantly, advance economic opportunity to help reduce the racial wealth gap. And so with that framing, we wanted to better understand whether and how California's various clean mobility programs truly address equity, but in a way that really challenges us to rethink the unjust systems and structures. And to do this, we developed a very extensive equity evaluation methodology that really digs into, what are those baseline kind of bare minimum equity approaches that have to be embedded in every single equity program? And then what are some of the more innovative and transformative equity approaches that are really pushing the envelope when it comes to developing and implementing these equity programs? And so using this methodology, this report titled Clean Mobility Equity, a Playbook, reviews 12 programs that are specifically targeted to our most impoverished and polluted communities, which are primarily communities of color in California. We note successes, pitfalls, areas for improvement, a whole series of policy recommendations to advance equity. And I can actually drop the link into the chat here. Oops, that was the wrong thing I meant to chat. All right, here we go, one more time. And so just to kind of give a high level overview, the report outlines very specific equity standards and strategies that every single clean mobility equity service or program must abide by, really regardless of the mode. We aim to be mode agnostic and really defer to what communities say best meets their needs. Every single program must emphasize anti-racist solutions, prioritize multi-sector approaches, deliver intentional benefits and avoid harms, as was mentioned, build community capacity, be community-driven at every stage, and establish paths towards wealth building. And so clearly, this is a super kind of comprehensive way of looking at equity. It goes way beyond the traditional measures of transportation. And that's exactly the point, because the traditional measures don't capture transformative, equitable processes and outcomes. But, at the same time, that's also really not enough. And so we offer specific examples of how those equity standards that I just listed can be embedded throughout a program's mission, its process of how it's developed and who's included in that process, its outcomes, and its measurement and analysis. And so to us, that framing is really critical. That adds layers of accountability.
And based on previous evaluations of equity policies and programs, we found that, you know, it was relatively commonplace to state equity as a mission or a goal, but basically zero follow through on a clear equity strategy for embedding that equity from start to finish. And so this report, it really is intended to serve as a guide for California as we continue evolving and improving upon our clean mobility programs. It also is a guide for other states and the federal government as they move to develop, you know, their own clean mobility equity programs and policies. So this was published just a few weeks ago. It includes very detailed information on every single case study included, probably way more information than you all wanted. But also in a week, we're also publishing part two, where we lay out some strategies on how do you actually sustain these clean mobility programs in the long run past the pilot phase. So this covers financial sustainability, community sustainability. It also covers some alternative funding mechanisms to cap and trade, because we recognize there are so many flaws with this approach. But I'm happy to dig into more details later on in this conversation.
All right, thanks so much, Hannah. And again, you know, I'm plugging all of these reports, but I really think they are each super valuable in their own way. And, you know, Hannah, I think you're noting that this is sort of primarily, but this report was primarily created to inform California policymaking. And, you know, having looked at it, I think it's fascinating and super relevant to New York State. I think the evaluation metric, right, that you all have created all the way from, you know, bare minimum to sort of transformative in terms of embedding equity is, you know, applicable across jurisdictions, right, in a really great way. So congratulations and thanks for all your great work on that. So thank you all for addressing some opening questions. You know, there are, I think, really a lot of different directions we could go in right now. I think, you know, I'd like to just ask a little bit about this issue of cars versus trucks, because I think it's come up in a number of your remarks. So, you know, a lot of the research findings that we've heard from you and that we know about from others highlight the role of trucks, right, of medium and heavy duty vehicles as, you know, a key driver of air quality issues in disadvantaged communities. We also know that electrifying cars, you know, that is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, right? And if New York is going to meet some of these reduction targets that are outlined in the CLCPA, reducing emissions from that sector is going to be a critical component of it. So I'd love to turn it to the panelists to just hear your reflections on, you know, what recommendations would you give to the state, to this advisory panel, on how to balance these goals of both reducing GHG emissions overall, which might suggest focusing on the light vehicle, passenger vehicle sector, right, while also improving public health, which, you know, as we've heard from you, requires focusing on trucks, medium, heavy duty vehicles. So what's your advice for how to kind of balance these dual goals? And, you know, we could turn it to anyone. You know, I know that this is an area of great work and interest for Anna. So I think I'd love to hear from you and others, anyone else who wants to chime in. But maybe, Anna, you could get first crack at this.
Sure. And I definitely want to defer to the EJ folks in New York, who have a much better sense of on the ground conditions. But, you know, when you look at the study that we conducted in Newark, and even there's other studies that have looked at the state in general. Gable and Associates did an analysis of the transportation sector emissions across New Jersey. And the reality is that, yes, light duty vehicles have a larger proportion of contribution to CO2, but the medium and heavy duty diesel sector, not just the mobile source sectors, but even the non-road sectors, are significant contributors to CO2 as well. And I think from our perspective, the perspective of environmental justice, starting with that sector is not only good for climate mitigation, it makes sense in the short term for public health, and it's also fairer. It's much fairer to start on the sector that's the dirtiest, because the reality is that that sector is often more expensive to mitigate, but it has the most immediate impacts in localized health, And if we don't target investments in that sector first, you know, what we saw in the New Jersey state modeling is that when you electrify and you prioritize electrifying the passenger vehicle sector first, it's more regressive. In other words, the entire state is paying into a system to turn over a sector that low income and EJ communities are not benefiting from. If you don't have a car, you're not benefiting from the turnover and the electrification of that car, especially if most of the health impacts to you are from the diesel sector in your hotspot community. And two, a lot of the electrification that's happening is happening on the backs of EJ communities, right? Because the electric sector also has most of its infrastructure in EJ communities. So if the electrification is happening in the light duty vehicle sector first and foremost, and most of the investments are driven there, the beneficiaries of that are not EJ communities, both from a health perspective or an economic perspective, or even a mitigation. We're not investing, internet's not that great, but I think if we really care about climate mitigation, we need to start with the dirtiest sector first, and work our way out from there to the light duty vehicles. I would defer to the folks in New York City, EJ Alliance, and others with the experience on the ground there.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks, Anna. So, you know, I think two clear points there around one. I think maybe questioning this dichotomy, right? Questioning the idea that sort of the medium and heavy duty sector doesn't contribute, right, in a meaningful way. And then I think having us think about sequencing, right, and what is the right sequence in light of equity. But Julissa, I want to turn it over to you. You know, Anna suggested, it'd be useful to hear about the experience on the ground from Nija. So what are your thoughts on this question?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with Anna about, you know, focusing on the most dirty sectors first, and then also echoing a lot of things that the other panelists have already said. But in terms of New York City, definitely, like, we need to incentivize, you know, medium and heavy duty vehicles to transition to electric vehicles, and also accelerating the transition to electrification of public buses. So, you know, New York City public transportation is a, you know, important piece of air pollution as well. And just, you know, investing in any electrical vehicle infrastructure in a way that actually, you know, makes sense and is helpful for people who are in transit deserts or environmental justice communities in general, but also just like redesigning roadways to support electric buses, only bus routes, and also like thinking about other options like cycling options as well. But yeah, I think I also just kind of want to emphasize some of what the other panels were saying about the top-down solutions just will not work for environmental justice communities where the air quality is worse and, you know, interventions can actually have the greatest public health impact if we focus on what's actually happening in the community. And each community in New York City is different. Like, what we were recommending in the South Bronx is different from what's in North Brooklyn. And also, I think, what Hannah was mentioning, like the fact that it's not just about transportation. Environmental justice is very, crosses a bunch of different sectors, and there's opportunities when the interventions are actually coming from, you know, the local communities to address other issues. Like, you know, I said I also work on green infrastructure, and we know that there's air quality impacts or air quality mitigation opportunities there, but also extreme heat, which is also an environmental justice issue. So when we're thinking about transportation solutions, not just thinking about it in like a siloed way, but thinking about how can we integrate that to other policies that may benefit environmental justice communities so that we can really improve the health of these communities who have been impacted by not just air quality, but just a whole bunch of different polluting infrastructure.
Thanks so much, Julissa. So, yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to hear from our colleagues from California, any insight that you might bring to bear on this question of, you know, thinking about different subsectors, cars, trucks, how do we sort of pursue all of these goals, right, our air quality and GHG reductions in an effective way. So would any of you want to chime in on this question in particular? Floor is open. Yeah, go ahead, Hannah, please.
So our transportation team works both on the electrification of medium heavy duty vehicles and light duty passenger vehicles. And I certainly believe we have to prioritize both. And I completely agree with what other panelists have shared. But I do want to provide a bit more context into the kind of nuts and bolts of our experience on specific clean vehicle incentive programs and some lessons learned there. So the reality, I mean, we have limited funding, right? And that funding should be solely targeted to the people who, you know, are suffering the most from air pollution and who face the most barriers to access. But unfortunately, we did not do this in California, and we learned this lesson the hard way. So specifically, the Clean Vehicle Rebate Project is not an equity program because it is available to basically everyone regardless of their income. And so as a result, study after study shows that it disproportionately benefits middle and higher income white people. And so again, you know, we have limited funds. They should instead be designated towards those equity programs like California's Clean Cars for All and the Clean Vehicle Assistance Program that are designed to reduce transportation disparities and don't actually widen them. And just some of the best practices from those clean vehicle equity programs are providing grants at the point of purchase, as opposed to a post-purchase rebate, which is an equity issue for low-income people who may not have that money to provide up front. Second, the grants should be able to be applied to used vehicles, not just used ones, new ones. Third, the program should build in the provision of affordable financing options so as not to cause additional unintended consequences and harms. And so, I mean, basically for... you know, this unique structuring of equity programs is inherently, you know, more equitable because it lowers barriers to entry compared to those non-equity programs. And maybe 10 years ago, non-equity programs made more sense as a way to kind of get the EV market off the ground. But it's 2021, and it's simply unacceptable that our non-equity program, the Clean Vehicle Rebate Project, has allocated about $1 billion over the years, and it continues to primarily subsidize wealthy white people's Teslas. While the clean vehicle equity programs that are doing a fantastic job at targeting the people who with the highest barriers facing most pollution, those programs are chronically underfunded and have incredibly long wait lists. And so this just goes to show that we can have great equity programs, but if we're not funding it in an equitable way, then we're never going to reach those equitable goals. And so we have to really put our money where our mouth is.
Wonderful. Thanks, Hannah. That's great detailed advice on program design. Martha or Will, either of you want to chime in on this question?
I'll jump in if that's is all right. I think one of the key things, you know, to the question, and certainly I agree very much with Anna and the focus on, you know, increasing the equity focus of the incentive programs. I think, as she mentioned, we've seen kind of the progress or progression, I should call it, of how these programs have rolled out. And I think the need to rethink and really look at where we can target and tailor investments into, you know, the most effective ways and the most equitable ways is critical at this point. It was critical 10 years ago, as Hannah said, but you know, I think the work that Green Lining's doing on this is very important for everyone to take a look at. I think that, you know, as far as looking at, is it a question of light duty versus medium duty versus the kind of fuel standard or what, we basically need all approaches firing on all cylinders or all, you know, synapses, right? We need to get all of these programs moving quickly. That's kind of one of our key issues here is we're not making these transitions quickly enough. We're not making these equity investments quickly enough. And I think on the heavy duty side, to your original question, you know, we know we need to address this sector. It's the leading source or a leading source in many places of ozone pollution. It's the leading source locally of diesel particle pollution. It's compounding regional air pollution burdens. It's accelerating or, you know, doubling down on local emission burdens in communities that are already overly burdened with diesel impacts. So I think two programs that could really, you know, speak to this are the advanced clean trucks, that zero emission truck requirement to get us on path to 100% electrification and in the trucking sector. And then in the, you know, shorter term, the you know, looking at today's engines, looking at where we can go in this next 5, 6, 7 year period, California's low NOx truck standard was just updated. Basically, it requires 90% reduction in engine output for heavy duty trucks. So 90% cleaner standard for heavy duty trucks by 2027. There are benchmarks along the way. It's, you know, basically one of the key ways we're going to attain health protective air pollution standards. And the other key to that program in the adjustments that were made is that, you know, it really looks at achieving real world benefits, making sure that a truck running on the, you know, in the lab can show that it's meeting the standards, but in the real world, driving at low speeds under heavy loads, it's putting out more pollution. It's putting out more essentially health impacting, you know, pollution. And the new rule captures that. It ensures that the trucks that are operating, the combustion trucks that are operating as clean as possible, getting, you know, to that 90% cleaner standard, but also, you know, operating as efficiently as possible in real world driving conditions, not just on a lab somewhere. So I think that policy, it's directly speaking to air pollution, you know, on the ground benefits, while we're also requiring this transition to zero emission trucks. We kind of have to address both things. I think those two packaged policies are a great place to start. And, you know, certainly we know that, you know, states have, you know, lined up behind these programs in the past. I think it's important for, you know, aggressive actions to put them in place now.
Great, thanks, Will. So, Martha, I can give you first crack at the next question, or you can chime in on this one. Either way.
I'll wait for the next one.
Great. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I'd love to actually follow up on this issue of, you know, clean fuel standards, right, that Will sort of teed us off with. But actually, I think it might be a good time to start hearing some questions from others. So, actually, I heard that, Jared, you might have a question that you'd want to ask. So please go ahead, and we can then maybe open it up to TAP members more broadly. Go ahead, Jim.
Sure. Thanks, Toby. And you know, I just want to again thank the participants in this roundtable. I think this has been a fascinating discussion, and, you know, really, really useful for you know, the work that we're doing. So, you know, I think it's been terrific. So I just wanted to say that. You know, I think we need to do both. We need to focus on light duty and heavy duty, and we need to, you know, sort of clean them both up as quickly as we can. Now light duty has an advantage in that you know, we're approaching the point where, you know, electric vehicles are going to be at price parity, and over the life of the vehicle, you know, there's a lot of savings associated with it, and, you know, reduce fuel costs, reduce maintenance, so you know, there's less intervention needed there than in the trucking sector. And so in the trucking sector, we're certainly looking at the Advanced Clean Truck Rule. That's one of the you know, proposed recommendations on the table. I believe that would require by 2030, you know, or thereabouts, maybe 30% of truck sales to be electrified. But what that means is that 70% of the truck sales will not be electrified. And so how do we ensure that 30% is going to the disadvantaged communities, the areas where, you know, we get that really significant public health benefit? And you know, obviously one strategy is providing incentives. That requires funding, and so I'm really interested in Hannah's ideas about, you know, funding sources, and looking forward to that report. But also, are there other strategies that can get those, other than funding, strategies that can get those vehicles deployed where we need them? And I'm thinking, you know, green zone strategies that, you know, I just saw Santa Monica has a requirement that only electric vehicles can now park on certain streets. You know, are there strategies like that have been deployed in California or elsewhere, you know, that we should be considering that will target the clean trucks to the areas where they do provide the most substantial public health and environmental benefits.
Great. Thanks, Jared. Yeah, I mean, given kind of where you went at the end there, maybe we want to start and just check in with our colleagues from California. Any advice on this question that Jared has brought? How do we bring the benefits, you know, of clean trucks, you know, when it's going to be only a portion of the market at the outset, right, to the places where they're needed the most?
Well, I would say, again, making sure that there's community knowledge at the table to deploy those. We have, in the city of Los Angeles, tried some green zones policy. I know some of our partners have tried state-level green zones policy. At the end of the day, what's happened in LA is a lack of enforcement of those policies, right? But it's important that those policies were not just about truck traffic. It's about permitting. It's about actually addressing the cumulative burden of pollution. And that's what's at the core of the climate justice demand from environmental justice communities and communities whose health is deeply impacted by air pollution. So I think all of those strategies are good, but it's really important, you know, to have communities leading that process and that effort and what's going to work best. You know, in California, we've developed a partnership with Build Your Dream, which is a major, you know, so when we do our toxic tours, we can actually now have a clean vehicle because we would do toxic tours in diesel buses. So I think, you know, figuring out how to deploy those, the money part, I think figuring out ways in which you are subsidizing those industries so that they are allowed to, you know, making it harder for them to externalize their cost of doing business, I think is one way for cities to think about revenues. I live in a part, I don't go to Santa Monica anymore because it's just, you know, the level of gentrification and displacement and top-down strategies that, you know, the city could do it in the city of Santa Monica, but it doesn't work in other places often.
Thanks, Martha. Others on this question, either from bringing advice in California or the perspective on the ground in New York or nearby New Jersey, right? What advice can we give to the TAP on this?
Yeah, I can mention a few things after, you know, like I said, we've worked in the port area in New Jersey. It's in New York, New Jersey, because we often work with the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey on all of their port infrastructure. And we've struggled with this issue for over a decade, you know, over a decade in terms of trying to really target the drayage sector and the port emissions sectors, which are very expensive and rely largely on voluntary measures, right? So there's no mandate that requires the turnover of the drayage fleets. And the issue always comes back to funding. And the reality is that the first thing the Port Authority tells us when we're in conversations with them is make us do it and then we'll find the funding. In other words, if there's no regulatory mandate that's driving them to turn over that diesel equipment and the drayage fleets, they're going to do it in drips and drabs. In fact, over the last 10 years, they've had various incentive programs and grant programs. They've turned over less than 400 diesel trucks in that time period, mostly using federal, DIRA money and Volkswagen funding where they can get it. So we need really strong regulatory mandates to drive those investments in this sector, first and foremost. And secondly, the kinds of investments we need, they're not going to come from marginal carve outs that come out of things like TCI. It's just not enough money. And this sector is very expensive. So it'll only happen incrementally in that sector if we rely on those sources of funds. So we've been talking in the state of New Jersey about is really where are the significant sources of dedicated funding that we can find in the state. So looking at utility filings, their EV filings, looking at port-related tariffs, marine tariffs, the shippers and the targets of the world that rely on the trucking industry to move their goods, are not paying enough into this system, even though they're benefiting from that system. So the owner operator truck drivers, they can't afford to finance the turnover of these fleets. We need to go to those industries to do that. So we're looking at things in the state, vehicles implements within the state for funding mechanisms that can really target and sustain those types of investments over the long term, and are not subject to sort of this regional trading processes that may or may not, you know, make a dent in this sector. So that's what we're pushing in New Jersey, and I don't know if that's a similar conversation in New York or California.
I would, you know, one of the jokes that we actually, in our moments of dark humor that we had at EJAC, is, you know what works? Telling polluters, thou shall not pollute. And we felt like that was our, like, constant refrain to the California Air Resources Board, right? We want a program that reduces emissions, not provides incentives to polluters to do the thing they're supposed to be doing anyway. Right.
Great. Thanks, Martha. I want to chime in. Yeah, go ahead, Hannah.
Oh, I think Will was about to speak.
Oh, okay. Will, then Hannah. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll be very quick. It's just a kind of a follow-up on Anna's comments about drayage. And within the California Advanced Clean Fleets rule, the kind of parallel program to the Advanced Clean Trucks standard, basically they're targeting a full fleet transition to zero emission in the drayage sector by 2035. We're supporting this effort and working in close coalition with a lot of organizations from your community groups and others who are pushing these strong standards. One of the things that is really important in that rule is that a truck would not be allowed to be entered into the drayage registry, this is the proposal, after 2023 if it wasn't a zero emission truck. So in order to hit this 2035 full transition, they're saying, you know, at 2023, the only trucks being able to newly register in the system are zero emission. So that's one, you know, key element. It's a very strong standard that they're proposing. The other piece of it is that there's requirements that older, dirtier trucks that are, you know, at their tail end of their full useful life would not be allowed to operate anymore. So there's this kind of retirement on the back end and on the front end requirement for zero emission. So you're taking the dirtiest, oldest diesel combustion trucks out of the system. Relatively quickly, not as quickly as we'd like probably, but at the same time you're pushing for the zero emissions standard to say in 2 years you're going to start only allowing zero emission drayage trucks into the system. So I just wanted to add that because I think Anna's point is really important, that, you know, that's a strong way to focus and target the emission benefits within one of the rules that California's working on right now.
Thanks, Will. Hannah, go ahead.
Yeah, just to piggyback on the conversation of additional funding mechanisms. So the 12 programs we evaluated in the report are primarily funded through cap and trade. But we know there are so many flaws with that funding mechanism. And so part two, it's called Sustaining Clean Mobility Programs, seeks to uncover, you know, how to sustain these programs in the long run. And part of that will be funding mechanisms, because we know that replicating and scaling up the programs that work will require huge amounts of funding that even cap and trade can't provide. But in general, you know, funding mechanisms really overlook equity considerations. They're not sufficient to meet the scale of clean transportation investments that we need. And in fact, you know, many of the funding mechanisms that pay for our clean mobility and transportation investments currently are deeply flawed. So, for example, the gas tax is very regressive. It falls more heavily on low-income people who have, you know, older cars, who have lower gas mileage. And it's also not sustainable in the long run, given the inevitable transition to zero emission vehicles. Cap and trade, I think we've covered it. Again, very flawed and is not meeting the needs of frontline communities in terms of reducing emissions. And so in this part two, we conducted an equity analysis of 21 innovative funding mechanisms. And we highlighted the four that really provided the most promise to deliver on equity in an intersectional way. not just, you know, with pollution and emissions reduction, but also vehicle miles traveled reduction. Also, you know, which ones will be relevant in a future zero emission economy. And so the ones that really rose to the top were road charging, which California is currently piloting, congestion pricing, which I know you all in New York are familiar with, low and zero emission zones, which is also mentioned in California, as well as a statewide tax on Uber and Lyft. Now, we recognize that even those funding mechanisms on their own very flawed in certain ways. And so we have to build equity considerations from start to finish to make sure that they are not, you know, harming priority populations, that they're actually producing benefits. We have to ensure that they are designed and deployed in a way that centers community needs and decision making, and not in a way that is coming from a kind of a top down approach. And so we offer some recommendations on what that could look like.
Wonderful. Thanks, Anna. Julissa, do you want to chime in on this, or have the first crack at the next question?
I'll have the first crack at the...
Okay. All right, great. So, the floor is open to TAP members. If anyone has a question you'd like to ask the panelists or an individual panelist, go ahead and you can raise your hand, and I will call on whoever I see. And if not, that's great. That gives me more opportunities to ask things that I'm curious about, but would love to give you all a chance.
I put my camera on, so if anyone...
Okay, great. Renee, wonderful. Please go ahead.
Sure. I wanted to ask a question, I think, to Will, hearkening back to the earlier conversation around air quality monitoring, and you mentioned the Road to Clean Air report. How does the Road to Clean Air report account for the transference of emissions from the transportation sector to energy, which was a comment and a concern that Anna mentioned, or does it at all sort of indicate that there's the potential for the threat to just shift to places that are, in addition to overburdened by air pollution from the transportation sector, but also from the energy sector?
Thanks, Renee. It's a great question, and I'm off mute. Thank you. I think that, you know, within our report, we did account for a shift to increasing levels of renewable power. So certainly, we know we have to make the transition to zero combustion on the road, as well as at the power sector. So we need to make that transition happen as well. In our report, we included calculations of an increasing level of renewable power while coal decreased over time. And again, it's a national study, so we looked at the national, you know, power grid within that. But it's a really important point, and I think, you know, we could have, we could look at a system where you say, okay, by 2030, 2035, you're at 100% zero emission passenger vehicles on the road and getting to 100% renewable power, and you would see those emission benefits or public health benefits increase even further. So it's definitely an issue of looking at the upstream emission sources and where they're located, not just making this transition to the vehicles on the road. So hope that helps. Our report did account for that. It didn't make, I'll just say, we didn't make broad assumptions about how much more renewable should go onto the system. We picked an off-the-shelf assessment of what the power grid could look like in 2050 rather than creating new scenarios for the power sector. So there's still, I guess an easy way to put it is that you would have even greater benefits in terms of public health by reducing that combustion in the power sector at a more accelerated rate. So definitely hear your concerns.
Thanks, Will. Anyone else want to chime in on this issue, or we can move to another question from a TAP member? Okay, so if you have a question from the advisory panel members, please turn your camera on, raise a hand.
It's Julie.
Great, Julie, go ahead. Yeah.
I guess I want to circle back a little bit to sort of one of the questions that Jared had asked that I don't think we fully answered, but I heard a lot about I'm concerned about what are we doing while we're moving to transition to the cleaner fuels, in particular, you know, in the heavy duty and medium duty sector, where, you know, the advanced clean truck rule anticipates sort of a long tail for that, and making sure that we are getting pollution reduction benefits, in particular in environmental justice communities, where, as you know, in particular, Anna, you highlighted, you know, the impacts near ports and from off-road vehicles, of what you think we should be doing while we're moving the transition to, you know, electric or zero emission, and mindful of the fact that until 2040, the state of New York is expecting that the power sector will still have emissions associated with as well, even as we're moving rapidly towards a greening of that sector.
Yeah, so Julie, I hear sort of a question in there specifically about, you know, cleaner fuel standard and making sure that those benefits do accrue to disadvantaged communities in this interim moment, right? That's going to potentially last, you know, number of decades, right? So maybe we'll turn first to our panelists from New York, New Jersey, you know, Anna or Julissa, maybe first crack at this.
Yeah, I actually want to bring it back to air quality monitoring. And so obviously we all know as part of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, air quality monitoring will be required. So I think definitely in the meantime, you know, I talked about this localized, hyper-local pollution that's happening in environmental justice communities. So really trying to understand that and think about, okay, when we're seeing what's actually happening on the ground in the community, and they're telling us like what they need, listening to them, and then making sure any air quality monitoring we're doing, the community is involved in all of those processes. So the air quality monitoring, and then thinking about policies that actually can help within the community, ones that can be implemented a lot quicker than, you know, these long-term policies. So I think really focusing on that and making sure we're connecting it to some sort of mechanism that actually makes sure that we're implementing enforceable policies or localized projects in the community. And again, just making sure that communities are involved in every step of the process, because this is where we're seeing the most pollution. And, you know, the community, they really do know what they want and they know what they need.
Thanks, Julissa. And I'm just noting the time. So I think I'll give Anna a chance to chime in on this question, and then sadly I think I'm going to have to summarize some ideas and draw this to a close just given the time. But Anna, please, if you have a response to Julie's question here.
Yeah, I just want to be really clear, you know, this question of low carbon fuels, we've heard that argument, you know, in especially because we're in the heart of the drayage sector, in the port sector. 10 years ago, you know, we heard a lot of, you know, chatter about, you know, LCFs, and it was roundly rejected by the environmental justice community and frankly by a lot of the folks in the industry as well, because it was just, you know, from our perspective, it was, you know, a bridge too far, and we did not want to get involved in false solutions to climate mitigation. And a lot of the effort we focused on was trying to leapfrog to zero emissions vehicles and electrified vehicles. And in the meantime, in the interim, what we looked at was actually retrofitting existing diesel engines, both at the crank and also increasing to, you know, better performing diesel engines until we could get the zero emissions and electrified engines. We did not want to go down the road sinking assets and time and investment into fuels that we saw as very problematic from the points of extraction, refining, you know. So we've been, unfortunately, in Newark, been the victims of a lot of bridge solutions. We have a 650 megawatt natural gas plant that was sold to us as a bridge. And so we are not really interested in LCVs. And I think, you know, we also learned a lot of lessons from our friends in California as well around trying to go down that road. So I just wanted to be really clear about how we looked at that issue, at least in New Jersey.
Great. Thanks, Anna.
If I may, okay. Just, I know we don't have a lot of time, but yeah. you know, when we actually listened to the community, we did a air monitoring project in walking the community, and the focus, and, you know, sometimes I feel like we got to go slow to go fast. And for frontline communities, we've been experiencing, you know, the impacts of air pollution, climate change for a long time. So this idea of listening, but also solving the lung level problems, right? So when we walked the community, we identified auto body shops, metal manufacturers, dry cleaners, which there's a perfectly safe alternative in wet cleaning that we can't get on the market because of the power of the chemical industry. But all of, you know, and so metal shredders, metal manufacturers, auto body shops, dry cleaners, all of, you know, figuring out solutions for those using best available control technology and BACT is, can get us to a lot of reductions while we figure out the alternatives. So if you focus on reducing air pollution, you address the climate change problem from a health perspective, right? You know, because we don't always have the technical solutions.
All right. Thank you so much, Martha. So sadly, I think the time has come to draw this conversation to a close. Huge thank you to our panelists. I think you brought a lot of value to the TAP. Great perspectives, great research. Super helpful. I know that they will be processing this for days and weeks to come. You know, most immediately on Friday, right, as they meet again. Just to note, you know, I mean, a couple of the themes that I've heard over the course of today, I mean, very loud and clear, the importance of involving communities upstream in the design and implementation of the policies and programs that you all are working on. The importance of thinking about how we're sequencing the benefits of these policies, right? And are they sequenced in a way that actually brings those benefits first to the folks who need those benefits the most? The importance of regulation and enforcement as the bedrock that's going to drive mitigation and drive benefits to these communities. And the value of on-the-ground monitoring. Getting folks who are in these communities actually tracking what's happening on air quality and potentially other issues, so we know the actual impacts of what we're doing. So those are some of my big takeaways. I've certainly learned a lot in this conversation, so thank you all. I will just turn it over to Jared to say some final words and draw this to a close. But a big thank you to all for volunteering your time and your knowledge to our benefit. It's greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thanks, Toby, and thanks to you for you know, a great effort at moderating this discussion. Again, I think it's been a fantastic discussion. You know, thank you to all the participants, especially those in California who were on, you know, starting at 8 this morning, helping us. And I also want to thank the members of the advisory panel that participated today. And you know, I'll single out Renee Reynolds for her help in identifying participants on the panel today. So that was really helpful and helped us put together a great discussion. So again, thank you, everybody. You know, that this discussion is certainly going to, you know, be something that you know, we'll be considering and in, as we, you know, finalize our recommendations. And hopefully you'll see some of the conversation, you know, reflected in those recommendations when they go to the Climate Action Council in a month or so. So thank you all, and have a great rest of the day.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye. Yes, thank you all very much.
Thank you.